Hello, and welcome to our program, Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest here on Owl Radio. First, your true stories. Readers share their not-so-scary ghost stories. Provided by Reader's Digest readers, here's Supernatural Visitors. First, from Kathy Redmond of Port Orange, Florida. My sister Wendy once nursed and released an injured hummingbird. It became her thing, her and her hummingbirds. As teenagers, we promised each other that if one of us died, she'd let the other know that she was okay. Wendy was the first to go at age 48. Sitting outside one morning, I felt something repeatedly swoop low over my head. I yelled, "Wendy, if that's you, stop messing around and show me." Suddenly, a hummingbird hovered in front of my face. When I told my daughter the story later that morning, she interrupted, "Mom, there's a hummingbird flying right over your head." It came so close it could have perched on my glasses. I said, "Hi, Wendy." She tweeted back and sped off. I haven't seen her since, but if I never do, that's fine. I know she's okay. From Karen Ivers of Faribault, Minnesota. My kids were 9 and 8 years old when their grandpa passed. Our daughter often said how much she missed him. We wondered why our son wasn't as expressive. We worried his reaction was almost too cold. Until he said he didn't miss Grandpa because he saw him every night when Grandpa sat on his bed and talked to him until he fell asleep. From Lee May of Statham, Georgia. We bought a small house on an acre of land that had been neglected after the owner died. Working alone in the yard one day, I felt 3 sound pats on my back. Later, I learned that the last owner had been fanatic about keeping her yard neat. I think she was thanking me for getting it back into shape. From Kathleen Sheets of Oregon, Ohio. My mom died just before my birthday. We both loved greeting cards. We once had worked together at a stationery shop and sent each other plenty of cards over the years, even though we lived nearby and saw each other often. I finally revisited the stationery store months after her death. I had planned a quick search for the cards I wanted, hoping to avoid a surge in my grief, but I noticed that one card in the humor rack was glaringly out of place. It was pretty and floral, with no words on the cover. I opened it to find out where it belonged. It read, "Happy birthday, daughter. You are loved more than you can imagine." I read the verse again. It was exactly the card my mom would have sent for my birthday. I still have such experiences occasionally and wonder, coincidence or mom? I choose to believe it's mom, reminding me that I'm more loved than I can imagine. From Becky Boudreau of St. Anne, Illinois. Logan, Art, and I worked closely in a chemistry lab. After Logan retired, we still met often for lunch. Logan was a bachelor with no living family, so when he passed away, Art and I inherited his chemistry collection. Old Bunsen burners, antique acid and base bottles, and textbooks from the 1940s. In his memory, we assembled a display cabinet at the entrance to the lab. As Art slid Logan's photo into a frame we had been gifted, he said, "I wish Logan could see what we're doing with his prized collection." Suddenly, the frame began playing, "Should Old Acquaintance Be Forgot?" Yes, it played Auld Lang Syne. Art and I looked at each other in awe. We had no idea that the frame even played music. We often talk about the wonderful way Logan let us know he was still around. From CD through RD.com, the light inside my mom's garage comes on briefly while the door rises. Once, we heard music when we pulled into the driveway. As we waited for the door to open, we saw several silhouettes dancing. I looked at Mom wide-eyed and asked, "Do you see that?" "Yes," she replied, "they're square dancing." We later learned that the land was once a park where people used to meet to square dance. From Evelyn Cantrell of McMinnville, Tennessee. My sister Jean was a fun-loving tour bus enthusiast who thrived on traveling with friends and seeing the sights. On the anniversary of her unexpected death, I tossed and turned and cried most of the night. But the next morning I awoke laughing. I had dreamed that a tour bus filled with adventurers stopped outside my window. Jean lowered her window, looked me eye to eye, and said in her most assertive voice, "I don't know what your problem is, but you need to get over it." She was too happy and having too much fun exploring for me not to, quote-unquote, get over it. From Suzanne Crawford of Manteca, California. My husband was the early bird to my night owl. Every evening he'd put his hands on the arms of my chair, enveloping me as he kissed me goodnight. A year after his passing, I was in my chair watching TV when I felt this rush come toward me. Without a second thought, I opened my arms for a goodnight hug and kiss. From Darlene Couch in Springfield, Ohio. When I was 8 years old, I slept at my grandmother's on a cold night. My grandfather, Pawpaw, had passed years earlier. After Granny lit the kerosene heater in the kitchen, we fell asleep on her feather mattress. I was suddenly awakened by someone shaking my shoulder. A man smiled at me and said, "Wake up and wake Granny." Smoke hung in the air as I woke her. She leaped up and got the heater out the kitchen door. She said, "Thank goodness you woke up." I told her a man shook my shoulder and told me to wake her. When I said he was smiling at me, she said it was probably Pawpaw. I believe with all my heart that he saved us that night. From Beck Boudreaux of St. Anne, Illinois. Everyone loved watching my parents, quote-unquote, boot scoot boogie across the dance floor. My dad passed way too young at age 58. Months later, my mom went on a cruise, and while she was away, Dad came to me in a dream. He smiled and said, "Tell your mother my legs aren't what they used to be, and it's okay for her to dance." When Mom got back, I gave her Dad's message. She asked what day I had the dream. It turns out it was the night of the ship's dance, where several potential partners approached her. She turned them all down because they weren't my dad. I hugged her and said, "Well, it's okay for you to dance." And finally, from Michelle Williams of Oceanside, California, my grandmother passed away in August a few months after suffering a stroke. On my wedding day the following December, I found myself desperately wishing she were there. That night I dreamed of her, healthy and whole, at my wedding reception that afternoon. She said to me so clearly, "Michelle, you look stunning." I woke up with a smile and tears on my face. My wedding day was so happy and full of love, and then there she was, the missing piece, telling me she was there the whole time. Next in Reader's Digest, inspiration. For years I denied this part of myself until I realized what I was missing. Becca Andrews from Jezebel.com presents My Southern Accent, Lost and Found in Reader's Digest. Before I thought I needed to shed my southernness, I was proud of my heritage. As a child, I dreamed of raising Black Angus cattle the way my Uncle Ted did, scratching out a big vegetable bed, making a home on an acre or two of grass for barefoot children to run across until their souls itched. There was no sound I loved more than my grandmother's accent. Thick, sweet, warm, unencumbered. When the phone rang, she answered with a throaty, "Mielo?" My own voice reflected my family's past and present, part northern Mississippi, part Tennessee Delta, all southern. As my childhood receded, I began to realize that outside of our region, Southerners were often dismissed as uncultured and uneducated, ignorant and narrow-minded. I was ready to leave behind my tiny town in West Tennessee and start a new life in some far-off metropolis. In that awkward space between teenager and adult, my accent was a symbol of everything I thought I hated about my life in the rural South. My conflation of vowels connoted ignorance. My elongation of final consonants gave away a rough around the edges nature that I feared would disqualify me from being a lauded magazine writer. My voice screamed out my class status. I thought I would have to talk less country, so I killed a piece of myself. I am ashamed of it, but I am more ashamed that I tried to kill that part of someone else. I met Emily in college at Middle Tennessee State University, a school known for its affordability and its proximity to Nashville. She was determined to work for the student newspaper, which is where I spent most of my waking hours, and she decided we would be friends. And so we were. She, unlike me, embraced her roots. She was, and still is, always good for a tube of lipstick or a Steel Magnolias reference, or a vat of homemade mac and cheese. Early in our friendship, her mother asked where I was from, assuming it was somewhere up north. I beamed with pride at the mistake. Emily is 2 years younger. I knew she cared about my opinion, and her admiration soothed my simmering insecurities. I advised her to be more like me and exorcise her signature Manchester, Tennessee accent. It was advice I lobbed at her throughout our college years, sometimes earnestly, more often by poking fun at her doubled down vowel sounds. It was our bit, I insisted to myself, taking that pained look on her face as part of the shtick. It was not fun for her, and deep down, I knew it. During my senior year, I took it upon myself to, quote-unquote, help Emily prepare for a broadcast she had to deliver for a class. I would be the Henry Higgins to her Eliza Doolittle. In a photo I took that night, she's frozen in time, her brow furrowed, literally clutching the string of pearls around her neck. Her lips are pursed, concentrating on pronunciation. I say firmly. Aye, Emily responds, helplessly. She tries to bite off the extra syllable, but it lingers, a thready pull of thick caramel. Exasperated, she tosses aside her glasses. Like, I say. Lack. It went on like this for an hour. I told myself I was helping her achieve her dream of working for NPR. Now I see that it was more about justifying what I had done to myself. My grandmother Carolyn used to tell me, "Girl, don't you forget where you come from." Memories are corrupted by time and emotion, but this one remained etched in my mind with uncomfortable clarity. She studied me with her clear blue eyes while she let her appeal hang in the air, sometimes wrapping her gnarled arthritic fingers around my hands. My grandmother is the foundation for what I understand a Southern woman to be. She said exactly what she meant, always at a slow, deliberate cadence. She was born and raised in the half-pony town of Pontotoc, Mississippi, the daughter of sharecroppers, known to me in family lore as Big Mama and Big Daddy. She survived the Depression, but for the rest of her adult life, she seemed haunted by the memories of what it was like to be poor. After she married my granddaddy, David, a boy from 20 minutes away in Hookah, they settled in Tupelo to have their own family. His parents fancied themselves city folks and did not appreciate of their son's marriage to a country girl, but she never told me this. I learned of it after she died, and now I wonder if that's the origin of her command. Don't forget. I tell you all of this because lineage is important in Southern families. It forms the base of our identities, and it is the context for the stories we tell ourselves and each other through time. Now that I am grown, now that I have left the South, it is important to me too. The process of eliminating my accent began in high school with Gilmore Girls. I carefully studied the speech patterns of Emily, Lorelei, Rory, and Paris, trying to memorize the quips and the pop culture references. After each episode, I'd stand before a mirror, practicing the characters' spitfire cadence in an effort to speak like a, quote-unquote, normal, white upper-middle-class girl. Eventually, I was successful at breaking down my tongue and rebuilding it. It wasn't just my voice that needed to be recorded over. The summer before I left for college, I lost weight and swapped my ratty pop-punk band t-shirts and worn jeans for the cheap, fast fashion at Forever 21. I lightened the eyeliner, wore tweed jewelry that turned my skin green, pierced my nose, and went to a beauty school to get a better haircut on a budget. And every time I spoke up in class or extended a fake confident hand toward someone more cosmopolitan, I did it with the clearest enunciation I could muster. If I was asked where I was from, I would say, quote-unquote, near Memphis, or make a derisive jab at my country background. Over the years, my career started to fall into place. I moved up to be editor-in-chief of the student newspaper, and I got an internship with the Tennessean. I credited it to the hard work of draining all the blood from my former self and filling her instead with tasteless, benign water. There was reason to why I did it. In the classrooms of my youth, there was a sense that to succeed, it was important to speak with perfect grammar and without too much country inflection. No quote-unquote y'alls, no quote-unquote ain'ts. Our teachers were reacting to a very real judgment that came from a quote-unquote professional ideal. This was before Dolly Parton was anointed to sainthood. In mainstream popular culture, white Southerners of a lower class were reduced to hicks to the delight of elite tastemakers. The Dukes of Hazzard, the Beverly Hillbillies, Forrest Gump, Duck Dynasty. When I visited the University of California, Berkeley to decide whether to go to graduate school there, I let slip that I was from a small town in the South, and a girl asked me if anyone wears shoes there. I forced a laugh, but embarrassment soured my stomach. 5 months after I tried to mold Emily into Eliza, I moved to the Bay Area and declared myself done with the South. You did have a two-tears-in-a-bucket attitude, Emily recalled later, a bemused expression on her face. I told her that it took me too long to realize that she was right to hold on to her Southern identity. I told her I was sorry. When we talk, I cannot imagine anything that fits her more perfectly than the sound of her voice as it has always been. These days, I feel like a radio operated by someone clumsily twisting the knob this way, then that, searching for a clear signal between what I sound like and the girl I used to be. Slower, fuller vowels roll off my tongue when encouraged by an extra glass of whiskey, some great indignation, the sound of another's drawl. But if my old self escapes from my lips in my new life, those syllables flatten back out minutes later. The quick, unconscious retreat to the safety of the unaccent makes me feel as though I'm a fraud, a girl who refused to heed her grandmother's warning and forgot where she comes from. My dad has said, "You can feel the call to home deep in your bones." I know exactly what he means. Once, every step I walked from the train station to the office seemed victorious to me. But I gradually began to realize that I no longer wanted to pretend. I became a kind of homesick that led me to play old Friday Night Lights episodes while folding laundry, or put on the Highwaymen record and dance around, singing with all the twang I've got left. On visits to West Tennessee, I would spend hours behind the wheel of my parents' car, pushing my luck on the country roads where I learned to drive, staring at the cotton packed up and waiting in the fields. I swallowed pangs of sadness for having missed the days just before harvest, when endless rows of fragile browning stems balanced their fluffy burdens, waiting to be relieved by gigantic cotton pickers. When I lived in Crockett County, I belligerently declared often and loudly that I would soon be gone, that I would never look back. Then it became impossible to stop looking back. In Sarah Broom's memoir, The Yellow House, she writes about her home, a New Orleans that is unseen by the tourists who mill about the French Quarter. She describes her homecoming, her hopes, quote, to close the distance between the me of now and the me of then, unquote. I read that line on a bus that carried me across concrete bridges and toward ambitious structures of iron and glass, and yearned for similar catharsis. I started to hope that I could reclaim and resurrect a part of myself. So I decided to move back. I'm still searching for what it means to be Southern, but now I'm doing it with all the quote-unquote y'alls and the quote-unquote reckons I withheld for so long. Next in Reader's Digest, 13 Things, collected by Emily Goodman. This time, high-flying facts about air travel. Number 1. Flying may not be as glamorous as it once was, but it still makes for an exclusive experience. Only about 5% of the world's population has ever been on an airplane. Although more than 80% of Americans have, still, upwards of 8,000 planes are in the air at any given moment, more than 5,000 of which are above the United States. Number 2. Today's planes utterly dwarf those from the early days of aviation. The bright red Lockheed 5B Vega that Amelia Earhart flew across the Atlantic in 1932 weighed less than 2,000 pounds, while a Boeing 747 can top 400,000. Each of its four engines alone weighs nearly 10,000 pounds. And the 1903 Wright Flyer went about 30 miles per hour. Most modern jets, however, cruise at 575 miles per hour. That's almost 7/8 of the speed of sound at 35,000 feet. Number 3. During a long-haul flight, an airplane toilet may flush as many as 1,000 times. And when it does, everything inside gets sucked out at speeds faster than Formula One race cars. Early plane toilets left much to be desired. Waste sometimes leaked outside the aircraft, where it froze and occasionally fell, damaging cars and houses below. Number 4. Despite what you see in movies, it's impossible to open the doors of a passenger plane during a flight. The cabin pressure pushing against the aircraft is simply too strong. Lightning also isn't worth fretting over. The metal cage of the plane protects passengers, and the electrical systems are built to withstand lightning strikes. Number 5. Everyone knows you can't smoke on airplanes, so why are there ashtrays in the bathrooms? The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, requires that they be installed so that rule breakers won't dispose of their cigarettes in the trash and potentially start a fire, which could then spread throughout the plane in less than 2 minutes. Number 6. Food poisoning made a few flights in the 1970s and 80s nearly disastrous. On a 1982 jaunt from Lisbon to Boston, the pilot and co-pilot both battled a bad batch of tapioca pudding, but managed to land safely. Many airlines now have pilots and co-pilots eat different meals to lessen the odds of them both becoming sick. Number 7, you can lower your own chances of catching a cold, or worse, on board by choosing a window seat and staying put during your flight. That's because, thanks to the HEPA filters, germs don't usually travel more than a 2-seat distance. If you do have to get up, don't fret. Cabin air is very clean and is completely changed about every 3 minutes. Number 8, when pilots say, quote-unquote, air pocket, they really mean turbulence. The euphemism is supposed to be a less distressing way to describe rough air leading to a bumpy ride. That said, there are no hard and fast rules about the seatbelt sign. Pilots use their best judgment about when it is safe for passengers to move freely about the cabin. Number 9. Perhaps you've seen video footage of particularly unruly passengers being restrained mid-flight with handcuffs or even duct tape. These methods may seem extreme, but crew members are well within their rights to use them. Although restraint is always a last resort, many flight attendants' kits include ties or tape. The FAA gives crew members latitude in dealing with disruptive passengers. Number 10. Putting your devices on airplane mode protects against radio interference, which applies not only to pilots communicating with ground control, but also to the sensors the plane uses to gauge its distance from the ground during descent and landing. Today, most airlines offer in-flight Wi-Fi, either by linking up with cell towers on the ground and simply connecting to the nearest transmitter as the plane travels, or by using satellites while flying over large expanses of water. Number 11. It can get cold at 35,000 feet, and with good reason. Hypoxia is a medical term for the absence of enough oxygen in your body's tissues, which often results in fainting. The high pressure in cabins makes the condition more likely, as do warm temperatures, so airlines keep the thermostat low to be on the safe side. Bundling up is better than the alternative, but you might want to bring your own blanket. A Wall Street Journal report found that airlines clean theirs only every 5 to 30 days. Number 12. An analysis from Popular Mechanics found that passengers near the tail of the plane were 40% more likely to survive a plane crash than those in front. But Arnold Barnett, Ph.D., professor of statistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, figures you could fly on average once a day for 4 million years before succumbing to a fatal crash. And finally, number 13 of 13 things, high-flying facts about air travel in Reader's Digest. Even if you have no interest in flying, you might want to check out the Unclaimed Baggage Store in Scottsboro, Alabama. The facility has exclusive contracts with all major U.S. airlines to purchase lost luggage, defined as not picked up after 3 months. Many of the bags' contents are donated, but some items, think diamond rings and designer clothes, end up on the store's shelves. And finally from Reader's Digest this week, some laughter, the best medicine. This from the Johnson City News and Neighbor. After trick-or-treating, a teen takes a shortcut home through a cemetery. Halfway across, he's startled by a tapping noise. Trembling, he spots an old man chipping away at a headstone with a chisel. "I thought you were a ghost," cries the relieved teen. "What are you doing working so late?" "Oh, those idiots," grumbles the old man. "They misspelled my name." From comedian Olaf Falafel, if you're being chased by a pack of taxidermists, do not play dead. From comedian Andy Field, I like to imagine the guy who invented the umbrella was going to call it the Brella, but he hesitated. And finally, these uncredited rim shots. Doctors got together to study the effects of alcohol on the way a person walks, and the results were staggering. I got over my addiction to chocolate, marshmallows, and nuts. I won't lie, it was a rocky road. And become an elementary school math teacher and make the little things count. You have been listening to Reader's Digest on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.